Part 2. Of the 30 days of the prophecy, there were but two remaining when Lannon Hyrcanus and his train came at last to the Bay of the Little Fish, on the furthest southerly shores of the Great Lake. It was already dark when 10 ships of the fleet anchored in the shallow waters of the bay, and their torches and lamps smeared long, ruddy paths of light across the black waters. Lannon stood beside the wooden gunwale of his steering deck and looked out across the fields of papyrus and hidden waterways to the south, where the open country began and spread away endlessly into the unknown. He knew that here lay his destiny and that of the nation. For 28 days he had hunted, and now he felt an unaccustomed chill of fear fan his arms and neck. Fear not of the terrible animal he had come to find, but of the consequences of the animal continuing to evade him. Behind him there were light footsteps on the wooden deck, and Lannon turned quickly. His hand on the hilt of the dagger beneath his leather cloak relaxed as he saw the unmistakable shape of the man in the light of the torches. "Hoi," he greeted him. "Highness, you must eat now and sleep. Have they come yet?" "Not yet, but they will before morning," replied the hunchback, moving closer to his prince. "Come now. You will have need of a steady hand and clear eye on the morrow." "Sometimes it seems I have 10 wives, not 9," laughed Lannon, and regretted the jest when he saw the blood darken the face of the hunchback, and quickly he went on. "You pamper me, old friend, but I think that tonight I will hunt sleep with as little success as I have hunted the Grey Lion these 28 days since my father's funeral." He turned back to the bridge rail and looked across at the other 9 ships, the ships of the 9 families. Come to watch him make good his claim to the throne of Opet and the 4 kingdoms. Come to watch him take his Grey Lion. "Look at them, Hughie," and his friend came to his side. "How many of them have made sacrifices to the gods for my failure?" "3 of them, certainly, you know which I mean. There are perhaps more of them." "And those who are loyal to House Barker, those we can count upon without question?" "You know them also, my lord. Habakkuk Lal will stand with you until the seas turn to sand. House Amon, House Hasmon." "Yes, yes," Lannon interrupted. "I know them. Every one of them, for and against. I was but talking to have the comfort of your voice." He touched the hunchback's shoulder in a gesture of affection before turning away to gaze once more into the southern wilderness. When the prophecy was made, did they ever foresee the day when the great Grey Lion would pass from the land? When a prince might search for all 30 of the days allotted to the task without seeing even the marks of the beast's paws in the earth of Opet? Lannon spoke with sudden anger. He flung his cloak back over his shoulder and folded his arms across his naked chest. His skin was freshly oiled, and the muscles glowed in the torchlight. He kneaded his own flesh with long, powerful fingers. "My father killed on the 25th day, and that was 46 years ago. They said even then that the Grey Lion was finished. Since then, how many have the scouts reported?" "My lord, the gods will decide," Hughie tried to soothe him. "We've hunted every covert where the Grey Lion has been seen in the last 200 years. Full 5 legions have swept the swamps in the north, 3 more along the great river." He broke off and began pacing the deck, pausing to look down into the hull, where the tiers of naked slaves slept chained upon their benches, leaning on the mighty oars in the position in which they would die. The stench of the rowing decks came up to him as a solid thing in the humid night. He turned back to Hui. "This reach of the swamps is the last place in the whole of my kingdoms which might hide a Grey Lion. If it does not, then what will happen, Hui? Is there no other way in which I might prove my right? No escape in the scrolls?" "None, my lord." Hui shook his head with regret. The kingship must fall. Unless there is a Gryland taken, then Opet will have no king. Who will rule without a king? The Council of Nine alone? And the Royal House? What will become of House Barker? Let us not talk of it, Hui suggested softly. Come, my lord. A slave is preparing a jug of hot, spiced wine and a stew of fish. The wine will help you to sleep. Will you make an oracle for tomorrow, my priest of Baal? Lannan asked suddenly. If the oracle is unfavorable, will it help you sleep? Asked Hui. And Lannan stared at him a moment before barking with harsh laughter. Yes, you're right as always. Come then. I am hungry. Lannan ate with vast appetite from the bowl of fish, sitting naked on his fur-covered bed. He had let his hair loose, and it hung to his shoulders, curling and gleaming strangely golden in the light of the hanging lamp. He was a godlike figure among his dark-haired people. The leather awnings were opened, and a light breeze came up from the southeast to cool the cabin and blow out the galley stench. The ship moved to the breeze, and the light chop of the surface, her timber popped and creaked softly. A slave cried out in nightmare, and from the deck above came the steps of the night guard, all the familiar comforting sounds of the flagship at sea. Lannan wiped out the bowl with a piece of millet bread, popped it into his mouth, and washed it down with the last of the wine. He sighed with content and smiled at Hui. Sing for me, my bird of the sun. Hui Ben Ammon squatted on the deck at the foot of the prince's bed. He held his lute in his lap and crouched over it. The curve of his back exaggerated the attitude. The long, tar-black tresses of hair hung forward to hide his face. His massively developed arms seemed too powerful for the long, delicate fingers that held the lute. He struck a note, and a listening hush fell upon the night. The footsteps overhead ceased. Two slave girls ceased their work and came to kneel beside Lannan's bed. The arguing voices from the ship anchored alongside quieted, and Hui sang. His voice rang sweetly across the dark waters, and the prince and the fleet listened. Dark shapes moved to the rails of the nearest ships and stood quietly there, looking across at the flagship. On the cheeks of one of the pretty slave girls stood teardrops that glistened in the lamplight when Hui sang of a lost love. And then she smiled through her tears when Hui changed the song to one of the bawdy marching tunes of the Sixth Legion. Enough, Hui said, looking up from his lute at last. There will be work tomorrow, my lord. Lannan nodded and touched one of the slave girls on the cheek. Immediately she stood up and loosed the shoulder strap of her linen tunic, letting it fall from her body. She was young and lithe, her body almost boyishly slim in the lamplight. She stooped and gathered her robe, dropped it across the bench beside the door, and stepped naked into Lannan's bed. The other girl went to snuff the lamp, and Hui rose from the deck with his lute slung on his shoulder. A voice hailed from the darkness, a great bull bellow from the edge of the papyrus beds that carried across the water to the flagship. Open your lines for a friend. Who calls himself friend? One of the guards shouted a challenge. And the reply was bellowed hoarsely. Mursil, huntmaster of House Barker. And Lannan was out of his bed in one bound. He's come, he exclaimed, flinging his cloak over his shoulders and hurrying to the companion ladder, with Hui scampering beside him. A small canoe bumped alongside, and Mursil came up through the entry port as Lannan and Hui reached the deck. A huge figure, gross and ape-like, with his big, beefy, round face, ruddy from sun and wine. The ship was awake now, her officers swarming up onto the deck, new torches flaring to light the scene as day, the bustle and hum of excitement affecting them all. Mercil saw Lannan and hurried to him down the aisle which opened for him across the crowded deck. He was followed closely by a pygmy figure, a tiny, brown, naked mannequin, that looked about him from slanted eyes in obvious terror at these unfamiliar surroundings. "My lord," Mercil opened his cloak and dropped heavily to one knee in front of Lannan. "I bring good news." "Then you are welcome." "This one." And Mercil reached behind him and dragged the little bushman forward. "This one has found what we seek."
"You have seen it?" Lannan demanded.
"The tracks of his paws only. But this one has seen the beast itself." "If it is true, you will be well rewarded, both of you," promised Lannan Hyrcanus, and turned to grin triumphantly at Hui. "The gods have decided. House Barker will have its chance once more."
The sky was only a shade lighter than the black brooding swampland. The dawn-flighting duck ghost-whistled unseen overhead, and each minute the light strengthened. Half a mile out on the open plain, a herd of buffalo grazed in a dark bunch. Heads down, tails swinging lazily, they moved back steadily towards the tall, dense banks of papyrus reed. They moved faster as the light strengthened, hurrying to reach the sanctuary of the reed beds. 200 huge bovine shapes, with their armoured heads and bunched black shoulders. Dawn's first light showed the white tick birds which hovered above the dark herd in a cold pink sheen. The swampy earth smoked with mist, and the endless banks of papyrus stood frozen in the hush of dawn. For once, their fluffy white heads were not nodding and dancing, except where something moved among the reeds. Following its track, the papyrus heads stirred, an opening and closing movement that set them nodding briefly before settling into stillness once more. The movement was sedate, and yet so weighty that it betrayed the size of the animal which stalked beneath it. The big bull buffalo that led the herd stopped suddenly 50 yards from the edge of the papyrus bed. He lifted his nose high and spread his ears wide beneath the heavy boss of horn. With little suspicious piggy eyes, he examined the bed of reeds ahead of him. Behind him, the herd stopped also, alerted by his stillness. The grey lion came out of the reeds at full charge, a blur of soft roan brown, an animal as tall and almost as heavy as the quarry it hunted. It crossed the open ground so swiftly that the bull had only begun to turn away before the grey lion was on him. It landed on his back, curved yellow claws hooked through thick black skin and flesh at shoulder and haunch. The long fangs sank into the back of the buffalo's neck, holding it steady while one paw reached forward and grasped the bull's nose. A single powerful wrench twisted the black neck back against the holding fangs. The spine snapped with a sharp report, and the bull folded in full run. Before he went down, the grey lion had left him, dropping lightly to the ground, seeming hardly to touch it before he was in the air again. A long, arcing leap, flashing soft brown against the pink dawn sky, to land easily across the back of an old black cow that ran beside the bull. Lightly as a hummingbird flashing from flower to flower, the grey lion had killed again, bone breaking sharply in the dawn, the victim carrying the great lion forward in the press of galloping buffalo, and as the cow died, the grey lion was gone, flitting to the next, killing again in one fleeting movement, and flitting again. 6 times the grey lion killed before the surging, plunging, panicking herd had run 300 paces. Then he let them run. The thunder of their hooves dwindled. A far bank of papyrus swallowed them, and they were gone. The grey lion stood in the silky light of dawn. His long, black-tufted tail still slashed from side to side with the thrill of the hunt. Every muscle was tight and swollen, and the great beast half crouched, the flat, snake-like head lifted as though to counter the weight of those long white fangs that curved down almost to touch the fluffy fur of his chest. The face mask was elaborately patterned in black and startling white, an effect that enhanced the golden, glowing savagery in the wide-set eyes. But the whiskers and eyelashes were long, white bristle, and seemed to soften the animal's expression. However, when it stood up from its crouch, with the short ruff of mulberry-brown mane along its back still fully erect, any illusion of softness vanished. As tall as a man, and as heavy as a horse, armed with those legendary fangs and claws, this was the most dangerous cat that all nature's twists and evolutions had ever produced. The cat turned and paced back to where its last victim lay in the short grass of the plain. It stood over the dead buffalo, and it seemed impossible that such a large animal could move as swiftly as this one had at the height of the hunt. The gray lion lifted its head, the massive jaws parted, the long pink tongue curled out between those unbelievable fangs, and it roared. It was a sound that seemed to shake the purple skies of dawn, that made the earth shudder and ruffled the quiet waters of the great lake.